All right.
Yeah.
Let's do it to it. Oh.
Three and a two and a one.
Well, I didn't even ask for it yet, but we got it.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
All right, that's pretty good. That's the best one yet.
My fly is open.
Pizza, pizza.
Bingo! Showtime!
While you were making egg foo young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing, Tech Show, when that fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that are linking bad. For the show links, go direct to DLFGS.org. And I see channels at linuxlink.net. Bound Tech Show. Just sit right there, cause the castle's just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 843 of the Linux Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we have Pat.
January's finally over.
We have Joel.
Good evening.
Flying Rich.
From the Hughes Outpost Orlando Command.
And Joe.
Hello.
So, Joel, last week you brought it up. Mm-hmm. And guess what I got to do this week?
Well, I don't know. What did you get to do?
These past 2 days, I got to work in Chef again. It's been like months.
I was going to say Tales from the Kitchen.
Tales from the Kitchen. Oh,
there you go.
You know what? I honestly, I don't remember the last time I did the chef work that I've been working on. Like,
Dan, before you get deep into this, do we know if Peggy's taking this entire decade off or just the first half?
Both halves.
Both halves. Okay.
He'll be in for the middle third. If that works out for you. But I don't know. I haven't heard from Peggy in ages. I miss him too. I wish he'd come back.
Come back, Pegwall.
He must be noodling. Oh, you know what? Speaking of noodling, I don't know if I ever said this on the show, but my next door neighbor, the previous next door neighbor, he was from Alabama.
And he showed you his noodle.
No, wait, he was from Georgia. The other one was from Alabama. No, he didn't show me his noodle. He told me that he was out catfish noodling one time. Right? One time he went out catfish noodling. And they were
noodling
out there and there was a bunch of guys.
Fish.
Yeah. Well, catfish noodling is basically you go into the swamps and you stick your hand down and you feel
for
holes.
For fish.
Yeah, you feel for holes and then you reach in there and tickle the fish to get it to grab onto your hand and then you pull it out, right? But apparently one of the most important things that you are supposed to do is
wear a glove.
No, feel the size of the hole. Because if the hole's too big, you ain't pulling the fish out. The fish is pulling you in, right? And he said this guy reached down there, and the next thing you know, he was gone. That's it. He was gone. And they never saw him again. And basically, his one friend said to the other, he's like, gotta go home and tell his wife.
Shit.
And that was the last time he said, once that happened, he was like, I was done. And I never went catfish noodling again.
That's so, a good reason to quit noodling.
Yeah, no
noodling
kidding.
Just sounds like a great thing to do, drinking with the boys, hanging out, you know, stick your hand in muddy water holes where you can't see what's going on and pull a catfish out.
But, right. So apparently some of those catfish get really freaking huge. And if the hole is like, and what we're talking about too big might be like the 5 gallon bucket
catfish
size or whatever it is they'll sit down there in these, like they'll get in these holes. And if you reach in and grab them and they're too big, they'll suck you right in that hole and it'll just it'll kill you almost instantly. So that's some.
I think they just killed the guy and took his wallet.
Well,
is really what I think.
I don't know. Anyway, Tales from the
Kitchen.
I got to
Google that one.
Tales from the Kitchen. One of the big things that we still use Chef for is setting up our cluster technology, solar, RabbitMQ, Couchbase.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to get the new version of Couchbase in. 6.50, which is the new version of Enterprise. And the version that we're using, I think, is getting close to end of life. And when you talk to Couchbase support, we have Enterprise support with them. The first thing that they always say, well, they say, send us the logs. And then the next thing is upgrade, right? It's always upgrade. Make sure you're running the latest version. And that's 6.5.0. And in order for us to do that, we need to pull down the RPM and put it in our custom Yum repo, which we have in Artifactory. So I had put in a ticket for that. And then I have to test the I have to update the Couchbase cookbook. We're pulling that version out of the Yum repo and installing it. So I got everything on my system tested out, set up. I was running it on the old version, was working perfectly fine. Today ran it when we finally got the updated RPM in our repo, and sure enough, like, I'm having problems. Like, you can see it in the freaking repo. And what I think, what I suspect the problem is I think the Vagrant image that we're using, pulling down the base, our base Vagrant image, already had Yum set up in it, and up the cache had been updated. And when I pull that image and use it, and it installs all the stuff, for some reason, it's not doing a Yum cache update first. It's just grabbing packages. So it goes to grab this, the Couchbase package, but it can't find it. And it says it can't find it in any of the mirrors because it's not updating itself, I don't think. But if I take it up to the point, and I'm just testing locally in kitchen, hence Tales from the Kitchen, right? And if I log into that instance locally on my system, and let's say I cut off the recipe to install the Chef server, when I log into it at that point and I run the same command to install Chef server, it won't do it. And I found out if I keep running it, it won't do it. But if I do something like Yum info Couchbase server, it triggers kind of an update to pull that information of the server, and it gives me that version so I can see it in there. And once I do something like that, or Yum make cache, I could then do just Yum install that package, and it works perfectly. So I think it has something to do with caching. I don't know whether it has to be done on the Yum server end or on the base image end, or whether we need to sneak something into the cookbooks to make sure it's actually doing an update or updated the cache. I don't know. So this is one of the things I'm working with today. Tales from the Kitchen.
Yeehaw.
But I was pleasantly surprised, having not done any of the work in a while, that that whole getup between Burks and Chef and VirtualBox and Vagrant, all that stuff was working just fine, and I was able to get done what I needed to do. But anyway, that's my Tales from the Kitchen. Welcome, Mr. Manfry.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good to hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
Just talking about some chef woes and celebrations.
Bye, man.
What do you have, Mr. Gorkon?
I've been learning everything I can about Kubernetes lately.
Oh, what are you doing?
There you go.
What's that?
Are you using just flat Kubernetes or using Google's Kubernetes? What are you using?
So we are doing Kubernetes at VMware. So now Pivotal is now part of VMware, and we're going to be doing it. So I'm actually going through all the coursework and whatnot to get certified as a certified Kubernetes application developer. So you'll see that next to my name here shortly. I took a practice test the other night, though, and I am not ready for it yet.
And Dan, I'm going to have to know everything you know, too.
What do you mean?
Because that's where my job's going.
Oh, to Kubernetes? Yeah. But it's interesting. It's a open soft. What is it? Open Software Foundation. No, not that's not right. Open source. I forget what it is. But they put together a curriculum and a test. It's 19 questions that you have 2 hours to take. There are sites that have kind of like mock versions of this. It's not the actual test, right? But there's mock versions of it that let you walk through different problems. It's very strict. The proctoring is very strict on it. I don't have to go somewhere to proctor it, but they have to be videoing on you the entire time. You have to clear off everything on your desk. You're only allowed to have a glass that has no writing. It has to be clear on it. You can only have one Chrome browser open and then two tabs, the tab for the test and then a tab that has the Kubernetes documentation on it. Like, that's it. Their interface gives you like a notepad, so you can't even have like an external notepad or anything like that. So it'll be interesting to see. I did a practice one the other night, like I said, and I did it in 2 hours, but I got like through half the problems, right?
You're doing it from your hotel room or your office or home?
I'm doing it, yeah, from wherever. I'm not traveling next week, so I'll probably try to, you know, get a bit more proficient with like all the command line switches and all that type of stuff, and then work through it. Try to schedule it next week while like my kids are in school, so I'm not getting, you know, distracted or bothered by them, you know.
So what you need to do is you need to set up a mirror that's just out of the camera range above it, that the person sitting behind your computer can see what you're doing, and then put on a screen behind the camera and your computer, which you're facing, the answer up there. So you could just do it like that, right?
I guess, but that'd be a lot of work. These are tricky questions. I'll say that. Like, there's like a lot of like little nuances to them, you know. So you have to go through and, you know, it'll be like one slight little thing that's off inside of there that like screws it up and it doesn't complete the. I don't know what they do in terms of like how it, you get. It's either all or nothing for every question, or partial credit, or you know what, you know.
Now, is it?
You know, the worst questions. I was studying for the VMware test, and it's like, pick three out of the five. Those I have the toughest time with. If it's one out of four or one out of five, I'd get it. But if it's, you know, pick the three reasons. And I'm like, all right, now in version 6.5, it was this. But in version 6.7, it was that. We're doing 6.7 now. So this some of these things are so effing hard because there's stuff you remember from prior versions, which I guess you're not dealing with yet. Some of these questions are really tough.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing out there. Luckily, I'm able to apply a bunch of the stuff that I'm doing like now to different projects that I have going on, and so that's helping me to learn it a little bit better and everything.
Is that test like available to the public?
Oh yeah. I'll find the link and I'll post it. Like, if you've been doing Kubernetes for quite some time, you could probably, you know, bang through it, and you need a 66% to get a passing grade on it, right? So you don't even have to complete. I was talking to one of my coworkers who did it over the holidays, and he said he didn't even do like five of the questions, and he still got like an 83% on the whole thing. So
I'm curious to see how the questions are.
Oh, so I went to this site. Another coworker of mine pointed me to this thing called killer.sh. If you go out there, they have like some sample questions before you actually go. You could pay, like, I did this because I'm just going to get reimbursed for all this stuff. But it's like, it's a European site, but you can, when the conversion happens, it's like $34.99. This is what gives you like the full on, almost a duplicate interface for the whole test, for the CK, you know, AD test. But killer.sh, I thought it was, you know, a pretty good resource. Then it's nice that after the time limit is up, they then give you all the answers to all the questions, so you can go back and kind of study. I was kind of running it on my own locally and then doing what I can. Like, there's a lot of things that are like already set up for you that you have to do, but they don't provide that type of stuff. But a lot of the other ones that I can kind of start from scratch on, I was able to go in and do those out myself.
Oh, you got to pay for it. You gotta pay for The killer.sh one.
Yeah, that's it, it's 30. The conversion to the from euros is $34.99.
Oh, I want free, man. Fry.
I know. Cheap. I thought it was gonna be two, but hey, I'm not paying for it, right?
No, that there you go. You're not paying, but I would have to. What's your credentials, mm-hmm. man? For I'll log in and take the test for you. We'll see what happens. What happens.
Hey, <thanks. laughs>
you did bad before. You're about to do worse.
Right.
You do a lot, Dan, with Kubernetes?
A fair amount. It depends on what you mean by a lot. Do I use, like, our environment is in GKE. We started with a self-hosted Kubernetes cluster, and we set that up. And I think those were set up with, I'm going to say Chef, actually. And then we went in and did some other configure, well, whatever. But while we set them up, it was more or less like, hey, our cloud engineering team had already put together a lot of the pieces. So we weren't like down in the nuts and bolts of it configuring it. We kind of got an idea of how it all comes together, and using different components of it. Getting I can't even remember the exact proper names of the separate pieces that you need to run to get the whole thing to function correctly, right? Because it's not just like Kubernetes. It's like you need to run like workers and a few other components, and like I said, I forget what the names are. And after we had that running for a couple of months, we switched over to Google Cloud Kubernetes Engine. So it's Kubernetes, but most of our interaction with it is the containers and everything that are running in there, the deployed applications. We use Helm, Helm charts. We build stuff that way. We don't use Docker Compose. So that's my regular usage of Kubernetes is through Google Cloud Kubernetes Engine and Helm and running kube control commands and doing stuff like that.
I gotcha. Yeah, see, for me, from a developer standpoint, like, I don't care about any of that shit, right? Like, I just want a place to deploy my stuff, you know, and I want to make sure that, like, my networking between my services is configured right. I want to make sure, you know, stuff like that, right? Like, I'm looking at, like, these plugins for, like, you know, Maven and Gradle right now to take my Spring Boot applications and do all of the generation of all the Docker files, all the services, all the service accounts, all the roles, the RBAC stuff, like all that stuff can get generated for me so that this way when I run my app through my pipeline and it gets pushed out there, it gets put to some type of registry somewhere and it can just be pushed out to, you know, to the cluster and be done with it, right? I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I care about. I care about, like, being able to switch profiles for different environments that I have things running in, you know, that type of stuff, all the setup and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm never going to do the administrator course in this, right? Like, that's just not my area, you know?
When you say that, I look at it as like three different levels, right? There's that, the having an environment available to you that you can switch around and do different things like that in the environment and make sure your application's running to deploy it out there fairly easily, have all that available to you. Like, there's that, there's setting all of that up, getting all that integrated and put together. I look at that as more like administration on that. And then the actual nuts and bolts of running a Kubernetes cloud an engine and environment, that's like engineering aspect to it. And those are just loose terminology. I don't necessarily think that's correct, but based upon what you're saying, like, I do a fair amount of the administration side of it, not so much down there configuring the nuts and bolts of the engine, Kubernetes itself, and how Helm runs on it and the namespaces and all that. I don't do necessarily that. But I do administration and utilization, you know, setting it all up so that the developers can do exactly like you say.
Yeah. I get more into the nitty gritty of, you know, getting build pipelines set up for developers, getting, you know, applications deployed and, you know, registering health checks and, you know, all that kind of stuff, metrics. I want to know what the apps are doing, how they're performing, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying there. One of the interesting things is, now, I don't know how you guys are setting it up, but one of the things that we did with, like, with logging inside of Kubernetes, like when you're running a containered application like that, it logs out to standard out, but you never see it because it's like a headless thing. But that then gets picked up by our logging module that's inside of Kubernetes and sends it off to Sumo Logic and parses it all out into the different namespaces and stuff. So, I mean, that worked out pretty well.
Yeah, we call it in PCF land, that's the fire hose, right? Like, they have other things that hook up to the fire hose and all the logs just kind of drain over to that, right?
Yes.
And I'm also expecting things to be available like Prometheus, so I can dump everything there, that I can start gathering metrics and doing that type of stuff with, you know, so I can dump it onto like a Grafana dashboard or something equivalent, you know.
Hey, there's so much you can do.
Oh, yeah.
Insane.
Yeah, like I'm messing right now. I have this application that I put together as like a proof of concept, right? Where it more or less is going to mirror, like, I have it running in the cloud and then on any number of edge devices. But right now I'm trying to get like Kafka set up and it binding to Kafka, and it'll run in the cloud. It'll run like that on the edges, and then it'll use Kafka Connect to bring the edges, you know, in synchronization with the cloud, so that any events that originate at an edge node will always kind of bubble up, and the cloud portion of that becomes not only the total source of record, but eventually it becomes the traffic cop as well. So that if things need to go between nodes for instance, it will be directing things back and forth, you know, when events arrive there. And then the cloud, anything originates there, will always kind of bubble to whichever node is actually expecting that type of data, right? So right now I'm modifying this proof of concept to try to get it to bind to Kafka, but for some reason it's just not working.
Now, when you do your development and stuff, do you work both locally and in a sandbox or development Kubernetes instance when you're working with your applications? Like I'll quickly just describe our environment. The way it works is, we have different applications and they're all local. Development is like on a developer's laptop. From there, they can make the code changes and test locally, and then also install it into a container locally and test it inside a container like it would be as if it were out in the environment. And then they can push it up. When they do a PR, it automatically checks out that PR in Jenkins and then builds the container and tests everything in the test environment. Once that passes and everything is good, they merge it. It builds the production container and pushes it out. Are you guys going to do like local development like that too, and then test locally on containers before you deploy it? Or are you just going from local up there into testing in containers and like,
so,
like your CI?
They're taking kind of like a stepped approach right now to this, right? Like all the applications are just built. They're just fat jar files, right? They contain everything. They're self-deployable, right? They can run on their own. They can run in a build pack. They can run, you know, in a Docker file, like if you want to do that, right? Currently, they do development just locally, no containers, right? Going forward, though, like that, all that containerization stuff is actually being done right now. However, the team that's, for some reason, I don't know why this is being separated out, but the team that's doing that has not pushed anything back into anybody's repos to say this is the changes we had to make to get this to work correctly. So I'm still trying to kind of figure out what's going on there. But our tip, I mean, this is all just kind of like cloud native, like, development, right? Like, so these things, if you've ever heard of like a 12-factor application, I actually just gave a talk about this in DC last week. That's why I was down there. But determining like your cloud readiness and being able to take a legacy workload and then move it to the cloud, where you're doing like a stage where you're kind of replatforming it just to get it to run out mm-hmm. there, and then once you have it just running enough, you then start modernizing that to get it to be running as efficiently as possible, building in things like resiliency across your services, observability for metrics and health and all that type of stuff. And so our framework, the Spring framework, does a lot of that stuff for you, builds in a lot of those hooks for you. So that once you push it out into the environment, I don't care now where you put it. Is it a Docker image? Is it running in a build pack on PCF? Is it running in, you know, OpenShift? You know, it doesn't really matter to me. Just so long as I'm building in a consistent manner every step of the way. And that includes like making sure all of my automated tests run in every single environment, and a pipeline will go just like you were talking about, where it's going to take a PR, you know, or just monitor a branch, right? Somewhere start like maybe a develop branch, right? And then once you're ready to push to master, like that's going to become your master build, or that's what's going to be pushed into production. And in the near future, that's going to all be containerizing those things. So they're going to go out to like some type of like a Docker registry. They use Nexus. That should be able to, that supports Docker images and whatnot. And they also have Harbor, right? I never used Harbor before coming here to this one. But yeah, this will all be pipelined, right? And then be able to be pushed out into any one of these environments.
What registry you say you're using?
It's Harbor.
Harbor.
Yeah, I was not aware of Harbor. I'm assuming it's an open source one that's been hardened for some extra use. But I don't know why we need both, right? Like Nexus does it, so. They're all kind of moving that to be just more general purpose, you know, repositories, right? It's not just, you know, jar artifacts mirroring like a Maven Central, right? It's apt repositories. It's Yum or whatever that thing is called now, repositories. It's Docker images. It's all that type of stuff.
Yeah, we use Quay.
I've never heard of that one either.
It's quay.io. It's just another repository. I had no say. I have no reason, no idea why they chose it over anything else. And then also we pull from Docker Hub too.
So. Yeah, these become mirrors for Docker Hub, so that you don't have to go to Docker Hub directly. Mm-hmm. And I try to get, and it's the same thing for like Maven Central and all that kind of stuff. I try to get people to not use the public repos for these, just use the local mirror. That way they can do whatever scanning they want to do and all that type of stuff.
No, I hear what you're saying. So Nexus looks like it's more than just container repository, right?
Right.
It sounds like Artifactory. We use something similar. Artifactory.
Yep, Artifactory is the Nexus and Artifactory are probably the two most common ones out there, right?
Right. That yeah. Looks just like Artifactory.
But Nexus for the longest time was just a let you store your own like your own library artifacts like Java jar files, right? And mirror other public repos that are out there, so you didn't have to be constantly taking that hit, you know hundreds of developers all hitting those things on updates, right? But now they've grown into all these other different general purpose repositories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we wanted originally, was making sure like all that stuff was mirrored internally. Because if for some reason the Yum repo you're using goes down and you need to build an image, or you need to build, you know, deploy something, if you host it internally, you have more control over that kind of stuff. It doesn't mean it's never going to go down. It just means, you know, and you also control when that gets updated.
Right. Which is critical, you know, because if your application ends up, like, we ran into when I was a part of a DR test, where we discovered that they did, like, a kernel update and changed the instance type on AWS from whatever it is now to an AWS Nitro instance and basically that's so that you can fail over from like east to west and stuff like that. Well, they discovered that we discovered during the DR test that when they did that, I'd bring up the listeners, which are Java processes. They would come up, but they would not bind to the ports. And they confirmed its incompatibility with our product, with the AWS Nitro instances. So, you know, that, you know, you don't want to just, especially in the cloud stuff, you don't want to just apply a kernel update without doing some significant testing to make sure that your application continues to work, as well as you can do the recovery testing that you needed to do if you want to recover, like if you want to practice migrating from east to west in the AWS cloud. So, and I'm sure probably the same with Azure and with Google as well. I'm starting to learn this cloud shit, whether I want to or not.
And make it marketable.
Get it in the tool belt.
Yeah. Well, I'm fully intending on working towards my AWS certification. I think the practitioner first, I think. So, because eventually we're going to, you know, they're working on trying to get us more permissions within the AWS console. Like, for example, I'd love to just be able to use AWS backup to backup a certain directory up to Amazon's S3 automatically without having to worry about file space on my instances and stuff like that. Because right now, I got several that we were doing it with OS scripts, and that works, but as I discovered, more and more from client to client, it's the same script. We try to keep the same script, obviously, but from client to client, there's little minor differences in the environment, either in permissions or how big the directory is. Like, I got some clients where that directory is maybe 5-6 gigs, other clients where it's 300, and it's the same directory for the most part, but it's just got different contents based on how customized they are and retention policies, so far as some of the directories have they're just dumping grounds for the reports once they run the report, and they can get to it and they don't clean them up. I don't even know if they can clean them up, so that's another thing we're working on, scripting all that crap out, clean up those directories and stuff like that.
And ultimately,
we got to clean it up with a mop and a bucket. What's the matter?
Ultimately, we got to move our for our Linux clients. We've got to move their host from. I'm trying to think. I think we're RHEL 6. I think maybe we've got to move to RHEL 6. Modernize.
What, RHEL 7?
Yeah.
Yeah. By the time you get that done, huh? It's gonna be 8.
You're probably more right than you know. There's, you know, we're growing, and that, which is a good problem to have. You know, it's like at least two or three clients have gone live since I've joined the cloud team. So, and I know there's at least three more that's on deck. Some of these are old. There's a couple newly implementing too. Those are going to be the harder ones, the newly implementing ones, because those are going to be longer. They're going to spend longer in transition, to get to insurance than our most of our regular clients. Our regular clients, that we can move them to the cloud fairly quickly. But and as much as I think our product isn't quite cloud ready, it's a lot better than some of our other products, so we got that going for us too. Now, if we can
figure out to get modernize it for you, Joel. So,
yeah, well, that'd be difficult. That'd be really difficult.
That's what we do.
Yeah, gotta figure out how to get rid of the Unidata. That would be helpful.
Get rid of what?
Unidata. It is a database that our product was originally written for, like 30 years ago. Okay. And it's essentially it's a database. It's not a fully relational database, but it's a multi-value. You can actually have more than one key in one table. So it's kind of screwed up.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can't do things like inner joins, outer joins, and stuff like that within the UniQuery language that they use to query it. It's difficult. Now, we do have it running on top of Microsoft SQL, and for SAS, our SAS clients, it's not just SQL, it's other the back end is currently RDS through AWS, but it's going to be moving up to I believe Aurora at some point. But don't quote me on that. But it's just exciting that we're going to get to work with these technologies eventually. So I'm looking forward to that. And it's just getting there. It's going to be a lot of work. Oh, and implementing. We just had our first training session last week on Datadog. You familiar with Datadog, Dan?
Dan.
Yep.
Jeremy Garcia is coming in.
We've got a micrometer adapter that allows you to. Micrometer is like an abstraction over all metrics collection that you can just build into your applications. And Datadog's one of the endpoints. That Prometheus is one. Datadog. There's like, I don't know, 10, 12 of them now at this point that they all like. Rich, you know about like SLF4J and that type of stuff? Did Rich leave? Is he there?
Nope. No, I don't even know what that is.
Oh, like Log4J?
Oh, that's okay, yeah.
Yeah, SLF4J is an abstraction over any logging framework, right? And so that's what Micrometer does. It's an abstraction over top of like all you can create your own like time series and all that type of stuff. And stuff like that, and all of that gets pumped out into something like Prometheus, and then you can then start running the native like querying that these programs provide over those different metrics and whatnot that you're trying to gather. And this is more than just like app metrics like health and memory, heap, CPU, all that type of stuff. This is you can start defining like business metrics as well inside of it, and start capturing, cataloging all that.
Yep. Yeah, Datadog's really powerful, but unfortunately, one thing that we found out after this training is our team's going to be responsible for writing the monitors that we already have written in Logic Monitor. So that's going to be a project in and of itself. so we'll see how long it takes us to completely migrate to Datadog, but. The one thing I'm hoping we're going to be able to do, some things I'd like to be able to do is, we still have to have, there's significant pieces of our product that are still written on IIS and Microsoft Foundation classes, so it runs on top of IIS. So things I'd like to do with Datadog is like, once we have a tunable for a client, we know, for example, they need to have on their UI server the maximum work processes has to be set at 4. All right. Well, I'd like to set up a monitor in Datadog that looks for that. And then if that value changes and monitor is re-enabled, I want to know about it so that we can go back in. I want it to actually generate an incident so that we can go back in and fix it. So that we don't wind up, because one of the bad problems with upgrades to some of our IIS-based products is every time you run the install shield over top of the existing website, it resets the tunables, which sucks. But we've gotten like good example. I'm on call this week, and we had an incident yesterday. That magically just resolved itself, and I'm like, "What's going on?" So, the client person, she starts writing up the incident report, and she goes back in to look at the website just because she wanted it like a reference, and she discovered the same error again. And this is luckily before the client noticed. So, I went in there, and lo and behold, we have used WSO2 for SAML for single sign-on. And there's a setting within our product that helps basically between any minor time differences between the servers. It's called clock skew. Okay. They had it set to 0 instead of 60. So once I set it to 60, bounce the application pulls, hey, it's not going down. And you could log in. So, and it's one of those things where it's like, you know, that's something that we shouldn't mess up. But, you know, it's wanting to monitor the basics that, you know, we already monitor, but I want to take it further to monitor our own cells so that when we do a particular upgrade of something, that if something's not right, that we know. So hopefully, I'm hoping we can do that. So we're probably going to end, that's probably the biggest project, part of that project is going to be installing the agents on all the servers.
Now, quick question about Grafana. I'm having an issue with it, and I'm assuming that it's actually a permissions issue, but I'm just going to check to make sure since you guys seem to have more experience with it. I can load up Grafana. I can see whatever Hugs Grid that I want to, whatever servers that I want to. But my problem gets to be when I try to change the date range so I can do quarterly metrics, all of a sudden it throws an error and I can't do anything. I've seen other people able to switch the date range without any problem, but as soon as I click on the date, error.
The only thing that comes to mind right now is this being driven by like a widget?
What do you mean?
Like you've created like a query behind the scenes or something like that, right? To build in like one of the, or are you just using like a pre-made one?
Pre-made. I mean, I've known about Grafana now for a solid 2 weeks.
Gotcha. So you might have to go in and look at the actual query under the hood that makes sure that it's trying to map to the right set of data, set of criteria in the data that you're sending to it. The data, the logging or whatever is different or changed from whatever you imported in from whatever Grafana dashboard you've imported in, you might find that there are differences in the naming of things. That's all. I would look at that. You can actually take that query, pluck it out and put it into, there's like a query window inside of there, run it and see what happens, and then try to play with those values there and see if you can reproduce it outside of the actual widget dashboard piece that they the dial or whatever it is that they put on there.
All right, I'll give that a try. Thank you.
Yep, no problem.
I didn't mean to kill the conversation.
No.
Just own it, man. Just own it. And can anybody, like, is anybody available, like, freelance-wise to help me with this app that I broke that needs to count stuff? Because I'm really having a hard time fixing it. I can't tell you who it's for, but, I mean, they'd be really appreciative if you could help me with it.
What do you mean count stuff?
Well, it just counts things and totals them from like a cloud type thing, and there's multiple different locations. It's counting things and adds up a total, and it's broken, and I need help with it.
It wouldn't be in the Midwest, would it be?
Well, so here's how
in Iowa. Works.
Is what I did is I changed my name to Abhinav Gupta, and I opened up a Fiverr account, and I tell them I'll write applications, and then they hire me because they think they're getting a deal. And I kind of screwed up.
Bit off more than you could chew?
Yeah, you know, this whole counting thing is a problem. I skipped Sesame right, Street and went right to the electric company.
That three is difficult.
Yeah,
number.
Because sometimes it's three.
So
what actually was the criteria to which they were counting? Like, is it in a sense like I just have this app that I say, oh, thumbs up, and I get counted for a person? Like, I'm putting a thumbs up on a person, or like what's the? I don't know. I didn't see the app.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it. I just think it's hysterical funny. I just really, after they spent $1 billion on the Obamacare website, now they can't make this work. I'm like, really?
I think Microsoft wrote it, right?
I don't know who was behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, so can I ask you guys a Linux question?
We don't know anything about Kubernetes.
No, no, no. It's about real Linux as opposed to fictional Linux that's virtual or semi-virtual or pseudo-abstracted user space Linux crap. It's
Linux
just real Linux.
Inside of Linux. It's just Linux.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. None of that freaking Russian nesting doll thing. No, that's not my question. So I bought a Nook. Actually, I got a Gen 7 i7 Nook on eBay, and I did a buy it now, and I totally lowballed them, and I got it for $200, and it was like nearly new in box. I was shocked. So I got 32 gigs of RAM, dropped it in there. I had a budget SSD I bought and dropped it in there, and boom, I threw some Ubuntu on it, and I was off and running. And I was thinking about making it a Hackintosh, but I hate to say it, I don't have a whole lot of time to F around with stuff. And then I was like, well, should I get like an Ubuntu distro that's geared towards video editing, or should I just get like a lightweight distro and throw? Because really, I was just going to use DaVinci Resolve, Blackmagic, and GIMP. That's pretty much it. That's all I need.
Well, if you're looking to do the lightweight distro and then toss Mac at it, Linus Tech Tips actually has some pretty good videos on how to do that.
When you say Mac at it, what do you mean?
If you're going to make it a Hackintosh by using a VM.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. I think I'm just going to keep it bare metal. I mean, I could go VM because I got 32 gigs of RAM, but
I don't know how difficult it is these days to make a Hackintosh. I know it used to be quite a process.
Yeah,
it's probably easier to virtualize.
Probably the easiest Hackintosh ever was the MSI Wind, because you could just download the DMG, burn it, and then boom, go, pretty much. There are a couple of tweaks to get the Wi-Fi running, but after that, it was totally no big deal. But I've played with the Nook a bit, trying to get it to work, and it's just a pain in the ass.
Are you looking to get, when you said like just like playing Ubuntu and then get the applications running on top of Ubuntu, or a distro spin specific
so there's,
for video?
Do you
mean like
there's
for
some
the
spins.
Nook, or just like they're not specific to the Nook, right? They're
right. Just, no, it's. I don't think there's really anything specific to a Nook, and the Nook is, you know, general enough hardware that it doesn't have to be specific to it.
No.
But I was wondering if you thought any of the media distros or media spins, as you would say, would be something you would recommend. But then again, I think it's probably too much overhead. It's not what I'm looking for. All I'm looking to do is really have GIMP and DaVinci Resolve on it. That's about it.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, I had heard good things about Ubuntu Studio, but I haven't actually tried it myself.
Yeah, I was looking at that.
The one thing I've noticed with Ubuntu Studio is, like, a long time ago when I installed it, like, certain things, like, you know how in standard Ubuntu you just get the little Wi-Fi icon, you just go up there, select the, you know, basically do things the lazy way for Wi-Fi, instead of going back to the command line to go hunt for your spot and stuff like that. It didn't have, actually it was Network Manager, wasn't installed. You can install it though. If you got a network connection, you can just install it. but I didn't have Network Manager installed, which kind of made things a little harder if you're on a device with Wi-Fi. Other than that, it's just straight up Ubuntu with the apps already installed. So you have things like Ardour's already there. I don't know if Kaden Live's the video editor on there right now or not. Probably not, because it's still GNOME-based. So been a while since I loaded Ubuntu Studio.
So is it the hockey puck or is it the Skull Canyon?
Oh, it's a hockey puck.
Cool.
It's a good price. It's an i7.
Yeah.
Have you used
Gen 7
i7?
So. No, I've used DaVinci on a Mac.
But yes, you can.
But DaVinci is Windows, Mac, Linux.
Right, but see, I was just looking. I was looking at a website, and I don't know what, like, I'm assuming they give you packages, maybe RPMs or Debian packages, but it doesn't specify. The only thing I see on here says if you're running Red Hat or CentOS Linux, you can even build your own workstation using low-cost motherboards, extremely fast processors, and mass memory, stuff like that. I don't see what, without having to register and then all that to download it, I don't know what versions of Linux let you install it.
Oh. I'm pretty sure I've used it on Linux in the past.
But I'm going to assume, I mean, at least Red Hat is there. I'm guessing it probably does Ubuntu through Debian packages. That is a possibility. I don't know. My personal opinion to your original question, if all you're going to do, if all you're looking for is GIMP and DaVinci, I would just go with straight Ubuntu instead of a media spin. Because a lot of times those spins add extra PPAs and do different things that make it no longer easy to upgrade without having all their stuff, the PPAs and all that stuff contained. You know what I mean? So if you could do it, if you do an Ubuntu upgrade, it disables the PPAs you have when it does an upgrade. That's what it wants to do. And then does the installation like that. But you run into problems when you have other people's PPAs with installing different versions of libraries that if you, it won't let you easily update things because of those versions of the library. And if you do, could break the stuff that you're working with and all sorts of things. That's why if you don't absolutely need to, I would just stick with plain vanilla Ubuntu and install DaVinci on top of it, because it looks like you're not going to get DaVinci in any spin, right? That's going to be something you're going to have to add on.
No, it doesn't look like that. And I'm just looking. There's a couple of YouTube videos here on how to install DaVinci Resolve on Ubuntu 18.04 LTS. So there's, you know, so at least I know it's doable. I guess the next question is, what's your favorite minimal install? I mean, because what I've done in the past is I've installed server and then put a desktop on it, like XFCE or so. Because it seems like it used to be in the past that server was the big install, you know, back in the day, and that your, you know, desktop Linux was the smaller install. Now it's the opposite. Because you get all of these Office and productivity packages, you know, and I'm like, I don't need that crap. I'll use Google Docs.
Or you can just, you know, you could just install it anyway and then uninstall it. I mean, that's fairly easy, you know. I don't know, like, a Ubuntu-based one that doesn't just include that. Like, even Lubuntu and Zubuntu include that as well. Does Puppy still exist? Puppy Linux?
Yeah.
I don't think I'd go near that though.
Here's the thing I always had a problem with, Rich, with exactly what you're saying, right? A lot of times you need to be careful of what, like, how you're installing the desktop environment. Like, it'll work, and it'll work for like 80% of what you want to do. But then if you don't choose like the right packages or something, there's little integration features that might not work right as you expect them to. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like all I would run into little issues like that where I would go to like, let me fire up like my file manager and connect to my Samba server. Lo and behold, that functionality is not there because I went with some kind of like really minimal install and then chose like
just what you wanted.
And something got missed, you know, like little things like that. It's not like your applications are going to break, but then you're going to find yourself maybe trying to do something that you would think would be there, but it's not. And then you got to like try and figure out, well, what components am I missing?
Cause like, Did you get stuck in RPM or dev hell?
I have GNOME installed, but why isn't Nautilus connecting to the Samba server or what?
All right, okay.
Or KDE.
Yeah, you know? I can deal with that.
You know, where's the file manager that I'm used to using?
It surprises me that most desktop-oriented distributions still include Office there. I mean, if you, you know, Google Docs is just fine for what I need personally 90% of the time. You know, so it's like I don't need the full Office suite. I just fire up open Google Docs. And the best thing about Google Docs is once I create a Google Doc, be it in a web browser on my laptop, or on my phone or on my iPad or a tablet, it's all there. You know, it doesn't matter which device I pick up, I can get to the document, you know, which is nice. So, I mean, you can kind of get that with standard OpenOffice if you have it syncing to like Dropbox or something like that, yeah. But then, you know, if you write a standard OpenOffice file instead of a docx or RTF or something like that, what's the odds of you being able to read that on your phone? You know, that's why I kind of like the web-based ones like Google Docs or there's another one too. Well, even Microsoft
360.
Yeah, Office 365. Yeah, Office 365 works just fine in a browser on Linux. So, I mean, you know, if you have that, like I do for work, you know, it just doesn't make a difference which one I use. So,
Here's another example. So, if you are comfortable in a minimalist desktop environment, or I should just say a window manager at that point.
Right. Like
Blackbox and Fluxbox
or Window Maker.
Or something like that. You know, then it doesn't really matter whether if you start with a server install and then go up from there. If you're going to run XFCE or GNOME or KDE, again, like one of the things you got to be careful of is in a minimal desktop environment where you don't have anything. If you plug in an external device, like a drive or something, it might not auto-mount it for you. And then you got to figure out like what it is you need to do to mount it as a user in your system.
Yeah,
like,
I'm okay with that.
Those kind of little things that can get mixed.
I know how the command line in block ID works. I'm good with that.
Yeah, no, that's all I'm saying. I mean, if you're cool with that, I would definitely, if you really want to slim it down, go with the server install and build it up that way. If you're not concerned about too much, if you're going to attach extra storage, you're like, I'm not really concerned about hard drive space. I'll just do a standard workstation install, and I'll just go with a slimmer. You have all that stuff under the hood. It probably won't be running, but it's available there.
Next week, Rich is going to come back on and say he took your advice and just installed Arch.
That's a joke, son.
So, yeah, I'll tell you what I was crazy impressed with is I installed a, you know, slimmed down Ubuntu. I forgot which version it was. And from power on to login screen, it was, holy crow, just unbelievable fast. I mean, we're talking a few short seconds. It was there before you were looking for it. So I was,
you're gonna have to remember which version that is.
It's probably in my directory. It's on my Mac, so I don't have my Mac with me. But yeah, off an SSD, it was just nutty fast.
It's like from It's Foss. It's foss.com/lightweight-linux-beginners. The best lightweight Linux distributions for old laptops and desktops. And number 10 is Peppermint.
Well, now, see, here's the thing. I mean, I got an i7, with 7th gen Nook. It's not a Skull Canyon, but it's an i7 with 32 gigs of RAM. So, on one hand, it's not like I'm looking for legacy hardware compatibility. And, you know, the same thing that makes a trim OS makes anything run faster. And realistically, that's what I'm looking to do.
Rich, you might want to just go with BusyBox on this motherfucker, because
yeah,
the Vision Resolve is a 1.2 gigabyte zipped archive download. Wow. That's pretty big. What happened? Where'd everybody go?
Oh, we're still here. Oh.
Yeah, we're still there. I'm actually typing so I can put that article in the IRC.
You know, looking at this download, I'm curious to see what it's going to be when it's finished, like what it consists of. At this point, if it is just like an application binaries, and you don't need to have anything else really installed, it's all self-contained, you could pretty much go with anything, I think. The slimmer the distribution that has GIMP with it, you could probably get away with. It doesn't even have to be Ubuntu.
Okie doke. And realistically, I could run any fat OS. I just, you know, if there's things there I don't need, I don't need Office. I don't need games. I don't need, you know,
just. Well, here, that Peppermint will run on a system with only 512 meg RAM and a 700 megahertz processor, and only needs 5 gigs free disk space.
Well, wasn't Bodhi Linux?
Actually, take that back. That's Linux Lite.
Wasn't Bodhi Linux like specifically made just to boot fast?
Yeah,
oh, I don't know on that one.
Actually, Peppermint is worse, or not worse, better. Peppermint only needs 4 gigs to install and a gig of RAM, which is not bad.
So here's something, you know, that I have a lot of legacy hardware that works fine. But I figure, oh, I can use it to browse the web or, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, web pages are crazy intensive. You think that stuff is lightweight? It's not. It's going to suck all your resources.
Whoa. Do you want to edit videos or do you want to browse the web here, Rich?
No, I kind of changed. Yeah, I kind of jumped the rails on the track.
Sure you can.
I'm talking about, like, my MSI Wind, which runs fine. But it's absolutely useless because everything we do now is web-based.
Oh, yeah. And whatever you're doing web-based. Atom processor.
Right. And whatever we're doing web-based is doing crazy amounts of CPU work.
I love that JavaScript, right?
Damn right.
You know what, Rich?
Remember back in the day.
You could probably just go with just Debian or CentOS.
Mm-hmm.
And it would, I mean, those are pretty out of the box, pretty small to begin with, and a lot more easily, I think, customizable to go from a small footprint higher. There's even other distributions. Because, again, this looks like it's just going to be an executable.
Doesn't DaVinci has statically linked libraries, if I remember right, which is why it's so damn huge.
Shit. this whatever minimal install you choose, it'll probably be smaller than the entirety of DaVinci. Holy man.
Probably, right?
Yeah, Jay Rulo has said Bodhi is an enlightenment-based issue.
Bodhi, when Bodhi, Arch-based, I thought?
No, it's Ubuntu-based. I just looked it up.
Okay.
But it's... No, there it's was, Bodhi no, Linux is of, like the enlightenment showcase, though, isn't it?
Right. No, I was thinking of Manjaro is what I was thinking of.
No, supposedly it just doesn't have any apps pre-installed in it other than Midori, Pac-Man, and Terminal Emulator and Apturi.
Right.
It runs the Moksha Window Manager, and it's based on Ubuntu LTS.
We're sitting here talking about enlightenment a little bit. That just reminds me, you know, how Facebook has the recommended friends. One of my recommended friends on Facebook was Carsten Heitzler, who wrote Enlightenment.
But yeah, pretty interesting. The Moksha desktop is a fork of Enlightenment.
Didn't so the guy who created it, isn't his like his online
Rasterman.
Yeah, Rasterman.
Yep. Rasterman, and then it used to be oh crap, I don't remember his Jeff Harrison, Mandrake. Back in the day, back in the late '90s.
Oh, hey, can I pip myself? I'm like 50 subs away from 2,000 on Flying Rich on YouTube. So if you guys are hearing this...
But getting 2,000 doesn't get you anything but satisfaction.
Damn right.
Rich likes his satisfaction.
There you go.
Yeah,
you can't get
I am all about it. Because, yeah, my wife... never mind. But I'll tell you the most disturbing thing is now that I have multiple channels, so when I go to switch accounts or somehow I'm not on my Flying Rich account, it says, you know, for account, it's like, you have no subscribers. So I'm like, or you have no content. And I'm like, what happened?
Yep. Little 3D printing tip, a short one.
Don't do it.
I had an issue with my MicroSwiss hot end where it just started to clog like crazy.
Your hot end's most... clogging?
Yeah, it was clogging. So,
I think you just had to suck the goop out.
Actually, here's what it is. Now, yeah, I did most cases. All I really had to do is clean it out, but it would still do that. So, what I discovered was, especially if you're still using PLA, the real reason to go for the all metal ones are to print things like ABS and other things that require higher temperatures. So you don't necessarily have to go to that. At least the design of the MicroSwiss is a lot better than the straight up design on the Creality printers. So I was surfing around YouTube and I found a really nice tip from I think the name of the channel was The Hot End. I'll see if I can find the YouTube video.
So you got a tip to fix your hot end?
Yes, I did. And that he suggested using, now, any brand will do, but essentially there is a WD-40 brand that I used.
So you got to lube your tip? And that fixes your hot end?
Shut up so I can finish it, Rich. WD-40 has a line of lubricants in their what they call specialist line. And they have a dry lube, which is essentially PTFE spray. So it's the same stuff that the tubing is made out of. Shot of that down into the hot end.
Come on, just say tetrafluoroethylene. Come on.
Yeah, tetrafluoroethylene, whatever you want to call it, PTFE. But shot of that in there, 15 minutes later, you can actually print 24 hours total for it to completely dry. But I have not had a clog since that happened, since I put that in there. So we'll see if that...
Are you using a brass nozzle? What kind of nozzle are you using?
I'm actually using a hardened steel now.
Okay, so yeah, the steel, you have less lubricity than brass, and so I could see you having that issue. And yep. So tetrafluoroethylene lube would help you out.
Yep.
And which is the same thing that was in Slick 50.
Right. There's other ones too. CRC quick dry, I think. I forget the name of it. But just make sure it has PTFE on the label. And you're good, because that's actually good all the way up to 500 degrees, so won't stick to it. Now, if you're not using PLA with a printer with a hot metal hot end, it probably doesn't matter, because you're printing in a higher temperature than PLA, and it's not going to stick anyway. But since I still have quite a bit of PLA, but this WD-40, and it's like $6 on Amazon. I tried looking around a couple places. I didn't look at like an AutoZone or something. They may have it, or someplace because if you look on the side of the can, it recommends use on like snowblowers and stuff like that to like lubricate the blade because it's dry ultimately. But it's in the range on this stuff is crazy. It goes from minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit to 500 Fahrenheit. So so far as the centigrade level, put it this way, I haven't had a problem with printing at 209 centigrade. So and it works great. So I got a whole can here. I'll probably take me years to go through that. But I think my next printer I may get is the Anycubic Photon. Yes, printer number 3, and I'd probably get rid of printer number 1.
Which one's printer number one?
The i3 Mini.
The one you can print sugar cubes with.
What are you doing with
it? The little one. I don't know yet. But I haven't planned on getting it yet. I'm waiting for my tax refund to come in.
No, what are you doing with the Mini?
Oh, nothing right now. I haven't printed it on it in months, but...
can I borrow it? Not...
Yeah, I'm not going to ship it.
I'll pay for shipping.
Now you don't want to mess with this one. It was a great tool and a great learning toy. But one of the reasons I don't use it is it doesn't have a heated bed.
Well, I have an enclosure that can handle that.
Yeah. I hack it though. What I end up doing when I do print on it, I'll heat the bed up with a hairdryer is what I use. Yeah.
What I would do is heat up the enclosure with a hairdryer.
Right. Yep. But it's, you know, I'll probably end up having a use for it because at some point it's just I print on my CR10 Mini way more. So.
Yeah, I've been looking at the CR10. I mean, it's almost, you know, bonus time.
Get a real CR10, not a CR10 Mini.
I wasn't talking about the Mini.
But, well, actually, I would go with the CR10 V2, depending on how much money you want to spend. Because well, the V2 has ABL, and it has a filament run-out sensor.
And right, the LMNOP. V2 right now is running, what, $399 at Micro Center?
I haven't looked, but yeah, that sounds about right.
So what you're talking, when you say ABL, just make sure people know what you're talking about. So you're talking about auto bed leveling,
yes.
Bed leveling. Actually, not ABL. It's kind of
BL touch.
So bed leveling in the 3D printer world is kind of like the foundation. You got to have the bed leveling right, then you can worry about all the other problems.
Right, correct.
If it auto bed levels, that takes out a lot of the mucking around with it.
Right, correct. And technically, it actually doesn't really do that because it's not moving the wheels on the bottom of the bed. When it does that, it's just takes
changing
measurements.
The orientation of the.
Well, so let me just lay the foundation for this because what you have to do is you have to auto bed leveling will correct for a certain amount of imperfection.
Correct.
If it's horrifically off, you're screwed. But just the amount that the bed would need adjustment after you like pull a print off that stuck real hard, it will adjust for that. But correct. You do have to do a preliminary adjustment.
Correct. Yes. And and it's that's exactly, you're 100% right. It's this, they call it mesh bed leveling in a lot of cases, where it basically just takes measurements all across the bed, and then Jonas is correct. Mesh bed leveling will let you print on a warped bed. Correct. Because I don't care whether you're printing on glass or you're printing on steel. It's very hard to make those things 100% level. They look level to your eyeball, but they are just that much off here in some spaces. So, yes. And if I were to replace the CR10 Mini, it's exactly what I would go with. It's one of those. Now, granted, I can probably buy all the pieces to upgrade that, but if I'm buying all those pieces, I might as well just buy another printer.
Well, I'm thinking about fixing mine or either buying another one, but I still haven't decided what I want to do yet.
Right. Now, because what I might do, like if I did that, then probably what I would do with the Mini is I would probably go get like a 1mm nozzle or something and use that for printing like the big stuff that I want to print fast, and I don't care how the outer surface looks. So if the ridges are there, I don't care about it, you know. But when you really amp up the size of the nozzle, it'll reduce the print quality as well as decrease the time it takes to actually print whatever you're printing. So certain things that I would print with that, I wouldn't care what the outside looks like. So, but like one thing I'm not printing are things like one of the big things in the Creality group on Facebook to print lately is the Mandalorian helmets. You know, I don't.
Well, a miniature. I wouldn't do a full size one.
No, they're printing full size.
I'm sure they are, but that seems like it would take way too long for too little return.
Oh yeah, they're days, dude. And then you got to think, well, if you really want to make it look like the Mandalorian helmet, you're gonna have to fill it, sand it, and paint it. Otherwise, it's just gonna look like a 3D printed Mandalorian helmet. Gonna look that great.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Gotta go.
Smooth it with like acetone or something. Later, Rich.
Love you using ABS. Rich. Yeah.
Rich.
Yo.
You're gonna have to go with CentOS.
Oh yeah.
Because their installer works RPM. So
well, okay then.
If you read their instructions.
Oh crap! I don't even know if I'm gonna have time to get to it before the next show. I probably won't have time.
Well, that's saving the effort of trying to choose something. I pulled it down, and it's all
there. You go.
Red hat based.
I appreciate the help, sir.
There you go.
Yep.
All right, guys. Have a good week.
You see you, Red. Yep. One of my latest prints, though, that I just printed. You've probably seen it on MeWe or Facebook. Was a Raspberry 4 or not 4 Raspberry 2 case, which is basically
That slim case you did.
Yes, I love it. It looks so nice. It came out great. And one of the things I was looking for when I was looking for cases for the Raspberry 2 on Thingiverse was I was looking for one that went together without any other things like any screws or anything like that, and this all just snaps together.
Mm. I did finally pick up a Pi 4.
I need to at some point. If the wife doesn't let me get the Anycubic, then maybe I'll do that. The thing is the Anycubic, what I probably have to do is I'd probably have to put the Anycubic, I think I can probably put it where my i3 Mini is, and then I put the i3 Mini someplace not as where I could still use it, but not in here. Either that or sell it, one of the two, because I don't use it that much. But the Anycubic Photon is an SLA printer with an LCD. Instead of a laser, it's an LCD for basically an LCD in front of a light, and then the light hits the resin and solidifies the resin layer by layer. And instead of building up from the print bed, it builds down from the print bed because it lowers the print bed into the resin, shoots the light in there to harden that layer, then it raises it up, lowers it down, raises it up, so on and so forth until the print's complete. And the resolution on those is much better than you would get on a standard PLA-based printer.
Yeah. I hear they have their own issues, especially when it comes to the fact that you can't really, you know, like, harden all the liquid in the middle.
Yep. Well, yeah, you have the prints will have to have drain holes in them. So that the hollow sections of the model will then drain out. Other than that, you also have to cure it afterwards. So you have to wash it with rubber, isopropyl alcohol. Then you have to put it in UV light, you know, either outside or get one of them little fingernail drying lamps. We'll work with that too. So we'll see. I don't know. Buying stuff's not really the focus for the tax refund. I do want to get something because I don't get bonuses anymore. Unfortunately.
I don't get good bonuses like I used to.
Well, I was getting good bonuses when I was in professional services, but the cloud assurance don't get them, at least at our level. Like the CAMs do, which are they're the ones that talk to the client directly much more than we do. We still do, but not near as much as they do. They talk to them every week, you know, so we don't talk to them unless there's a problem. Goodness, excuse me.
Yeah, it's getting to be that time. I gotta go cook my supper here in a second.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
So you need to do crock pot stuff like I've been doing lately.
Crock pot.
No, yeah, I'll stick with the grill and just have some
there
fish.
You go. Yeah, I did beef stew this week, and then this morning before I started work, since I'm starting work late, because I'm on duty or on call, I went to the store and I found it's like one of the McCormick spice packs called the Fiesta Chicken. So I used that pack, a couple of chicken breasts in the crock pot, a couple cans of diced tomatoes,
10 pounds of garlic.
No.
Why not?
Well, you could put that in there, but no, I didn't. A can of corn, a can of black beans, and then you cook it on high in the crock pot. We can also do low for a longer time. I cooked it on high for 4 hours, and then I took the chicken breast out. It was still warm, and then shredded the chicken breast and then threw that back in there and mixed it up. And then you can throw that on top of rice, or you can throw it in a tortilla like I did for dinner.
Except I don't eat rice or tortillas or bread.
Carb balance.
Noodles.
Carb balance tortillas is what I went with. So. And only one. So you can just eat. Of course, you can do like my wife did. She just threw it on a plate and ate it.
Well, at least you didn't throw it in the garbage, right?
At least she ate it. I don't know. Okay. It's one of those things where when I work the late hours, I want to have stuff that is easy to cook, so that either she can cook it or that I can just put it in the crock pot before I start work, and that's usually the best thing to do. I guess I can throw it like an instant pot. Hours or before I'm ready to use it. After 5 Eastern, things start to slow down until we have the handoff call at 7:30. So usually anything.
All right, guys, I'm gonna go cook. I'll talk to you later.
Have a good one.
Go cook.
We gotta wrap this up, Joe.
Hey guys.
Joe.
And look, I won't cut it on the show.
You're cutting in and out.
I am.
Yeah, I don't know why that's bad.
Yeah, you have been for the last like 5 minutes there, Joe.
That is weird. I was gonna say, if you have CBS Online, watch Picard. I've watched the first 2 episodes. While it's not perfect, it's not bad.
Yeah, I watched the first one on Amazon Prime. I dug it. I still can't justify paying for CBS since I already pay for CBS, you know, through some other means, right?
Well, what I do, there are more than one plan. I pay for $6 a month, which gets you enough to watch the shows that there are ads in it, and I don't care. So,
wait, is Picard on Amazon Prime?
Nope.
They did the first episode.
They did the first episode on Amazon Prime and on YouTube. And I believe it's also on Pluto as well.
Alright. Check it out, says Joel.
Yep. Check it out.
Says, don't pay for it. Well. All right. Here you go. Thank you, everybody. Here are your promos.
Later.
Thank you, Man Fry. Thank you, Joel. Great to hear from you guys. And here
good is. Evening.
Ba-da-ba-da-ba. Take it away, classes.
Oh, my God.
It's Hacker
Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
Open source, Linux, computers, electronics, science, and amateur radio. We cover it all. Who are we? We are Linux in the Ham Shack, the podcast that brings you and your technology together with the power of software freedom. Drop us in your favorite podcatcher or join us every other Tuesday night for the interactive live show. Visit LHSpodcast.info for all the details, news, and information. We are Linux in the Ham Shack, and we want to open your mind.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush.
Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
Well, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
Mm-hmm.
Aha! Oh. Oh, man, I'm tired tonight.
You said you're tired?
Yeah, I'm tired. I'm ready for bed, Joel. But the people need the
last
show.
2 nights, man. Right. Mm-hmm. But last 2 nights, right at the handoff call, guess what? I get paged. Isn't that great?
What time are you? What time? Like, what was your hour?
One was
hours?
A C. Basically, I pick up when it starts to get, you know, when it starts to be night in India. So at 11 o'clock in the morning, we have a handoff call. Then any of the pages. Now, I have, like, when there's no calls coming in, I have stuff I can do. No problem. Requests and stuff to work on. Okay? So it's not like I sit there doing nothing all day. But basically, when the phone hops, I have to jump. And if it's a P1, invariably there's going to be a Zoom session that the CBU will open up, and I have to hop on that and do the work. So, and I only have one of those this week. The rest of them have been P2s. And we page on P2s as well now. But 9 times out of 10, it's something in non-production or something, so you can just go ahead and fix it and be done. We have to submit emergency changes if there's something that we have to fix.
What time does your on-call end?
Yeah.
No, what time does it end?
We have turnover call at 7:30.
Okay.
7:30 is when it ends, at night. So never overnight. I get to sleep.
I'm like on call all the time.
We're also on call on the weekend during the day. Yeah. I'm on call like on the weekend as well, both Saturday and Sunday. And there's only one weekend maintenance that we have to do, although I'm not to do that this week. I got somebody else doing it, but I'm probably going to shadow him when he does it. And it's not anything that I haven't done before. But just to make sure that, I'm gonna watch him to make sure that I see it before I go do it on my own. And eventually, we got a couple clients. Like, there's like 3 clients that have maintenance windows at like dark 30 on Sunday, and I think eventually they should go to the India team, because there's the only problem with our product, with the India team, is that our product is pretty much North America specific. Uh-huh. So we're talking United States, Canada, and Mexico mostly. That's it. Nobody, like, most countries can't, like, European countries cannot use it. So. The Indian team just don't have a lot of the things that are in air. Doesn't necessarily mean anything to them. You know, it's not like you're going to go find somebody that's living in Bangalore that knows colleague like we do. So when it gets to be a little bit of like where they do their best job is when you just give them a step-by-step list of stuff to do, you know, but if you have to, you know, if it's something that kind of requires a little bit of analysis or something, then they want us to do it. So I'm hoping that we can start to train them up a little bit and get it so that, you know, when we need to do those late night ones, that we can hand them over to them. Because honestly, that's who should be doing it, because they're up and alert and they're not been up all day and have to do something on a whim in the middle of the night. Anyway. Alright, you go to bed, dude.
I gotta get the show out, man.
Now see ya.
So, say good night.
Good night.
Alright, man, you have a good week.
Line Highway, there's a whole bunch of farmland out there. I'm thinking I probably could find a farmer that'll put a dirt mound on his property and let me pay him some money to go there and shoot.
Shoot big old blocks of tannerite, huh?
Well, you know, actually, there's nobody living out there. Nobody know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost time. Where's we got Dan O'Dell.
He's coming. Okay. He's just slow. Actually, I just got off work because I'm on call this week. And
off work? What? Does that mean you closed the laptop?
Yeah. It was. I'm on call this week, so my shift, my normal days are 8:30 to 5:30. On my on-call weeks, it's 11 to about 8. So it's not too bad. At least get to go to the gym in the morning, and last couple days I threw stuff in a crock pot to eat. Made some beef stew.
Oh, I was wondering, I saw tonight. You posting you were in the gym in the morning, and I was like, yeah, what's he doing?
Yep, I don't have to start work till 11, so might as well go ahead and wake up my normal time, even when I'm working later. It's just, you know.
I got up at 5 a.m. and drove the 150 miles to work today.
I go to pull the tubing off of the hot end, and it wouldn't come off. Ah, damn. I don't put out as regularly.
Don't put out anymore at all, podcast-wise. Anyhow,
was that what you were talking
Dan's
about?
Dan's having fun. I think that's what it was, yeah.
All right, Dan, where is that was with my mouth?
That was a long time ago. All that was a long time ago. It's about 2 months till Murph.
It was with my mouth.
Dan needs to write himself a little Python soundboard or something.
Yeah, well, he's got some app, right?
No.
Yeah, it's called XMMS.
It's called a terminal with MPlayer running. That's why I took a second. I had to go find it. Good evening. How's everybody doing today?
Peachy.
Wonderful, except that I wrote an app and it failed and it was on the news.
You did not. You do not work for Shadow.
Bum, bum, bum.
The pastor at church asked me if I knew how to write an app. I'm like, no, sorry.
You're gonna write an app for the. You're gonna write an app
for the Capital City Church. That's our name. That's our name now.
To play your videos.
I think basically once like kind of like a easy way to get the website information stuff like that. So actually, come to think of it, I'm wondering if we use. It easy.
All right. Hey, it's about time to start the show.
It's too early. It's 8:33.
That's what she said.
All right, we got everything all ready to go. Let's
see. Mm-hmm.
What's going on in the chat? I don't know. Going on at Pornhub these days, Joel?
I don't know.
That's 8:43. Is this week's show? 8:43. You ready, Joe?
No, not really. But it's okay.
Wait a second. Speak again.
Okay.
Oh, because last time you were talking,
I like saw the lips turn red for Flying Rich, and I'm like, wait a minute, that can't be right. Look, there he goes.
Yeah, okay. I'm secretly at his house, hanging out with him.
Is it picking you secret. Up, too?
Yeah, his wife doesn't know, so don't tell her.
Okay.
Hello.
Well, yeah, nobody knows. I'm in
you
Orlando.
Need to do is hang out right next to the chocolate bar in the fridge in the garage, and she'll never know, right, Rich?
Dude, wow. And you know, she subbed my channel. I'm surprised she hasn't seen that. When the video is titled "I'm cheating on my wife," you know, some woman told me I was a jerk.
Well, she's right.
You need to watch the video. Well, yeah, she's right, but not for the reason she thinks.
Hey, Dan, your voice sounds very quiet today.
Yeah.
Is that better?
Much.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's okay. Better.
It helps when the mic's like, right near me, not on the other side of the table.
That would help.
So, I can't spend a whole lot of time here today because I got to fix that app that was supposed to count some things. I'm getting into a lot of trouble because it's not working right.
What a cluster.